On the Pilot TV podcast this week, we are taking relationship advice from Jessica Chastain and Oscar Isaac in Scenes from a Marriage on Sky Atlantic. Very much not taking relationship advice from Penn Badgley in season 3 of You on Netflix, and watching Robert Carlyle try to run the country in the second series of Sky Max's Cobra, now called Cobra Cyberwar. I'm James Dyer, and welcome to the Pilot TV podcast, your weekly guide to a wide range of shows that Beth may or may not have written extensive 2,000-word articles on that neither Boyd nor I have any recollection of. And speaking of which, I am joined today by both of the aforementioned TV's Boyd Hilton and Pilot's resident Friday Night Lights expert, Beth Webb. How are you?
Basking in the glow of your validation, James.
I took Thank a lot so of good. Shit on Twitter this week, I don't mind telling you.
I will say, though, I mean... And thank you, Twitter, for leaping to my defense. But I did witness last week, James making a point and then Boyd making the same point about 10 minutes later. So I will say that whereas, you know, it is an inherently gendered thing to be ignored in the workplace, everybody ignores
on the Pilot TV podcast, it's gender agnostic.
I think it's an egalitarian thing. And one of our regular correspondents on Twitter said something to the effect of, how dare any of you multitask during the recording of, you know, their favourite podcast?
Yeah.
Because, you know, famously, you know, Terry Sizzle emails. And I think it was when you, James, were more involved in a lengthy discussion about some science fiction.
Oh, anytime I start speaking, yeah. I used to see Terry immediately be like, and I'm going to do emails.
My excuse for repeating something that James said 10 minutes earlier is that I'm often like looking at my laptop, I'm looking at my notes, I've got my notes, I've got, you know, different things. And I sometimes get distracted by my own. Yeah. Attempt to be accurate. That's my explanation.
Yes,
I feel like I'm hoist by my own petard a little bit, or my own Picard, if you will, because I have a tendency to do things like that and go, well, Boyd, funny you should mention Picard. But, and then you're just like, and your brain goes, and switch off. We are now in for a lengthy James-splanation that we do not need to hear.
Plus, I know for a fact that James repeats things I've said 10 minutes later.
Oh, yeah, of course. It's a level playing field. Yeah, absolutely.
Good. I'm glad we've established that.
Yeah, it happens on Empire as well. It happens much more so on this particular podcast. There are a few things that we need to, a little bit of housekeeping I think we need to do. So we're going to go into what we've been watching, but I'm going to start what we've been watching by saying what I haven't been watching. And what I haven't been watching is Gilmore Girls, and it's also Always Funny in Philadelphia. Always Funny in Philadelphia? It might always be funny in Philadelphia, but it is always sunny in Philadelphia. I've watched neither of these shows, so I can only apologise to both of you for being horribly remiss in my viewing. Mm. And it's only because I have too much shit to watch. We have moved our recording day forward. So we used to do it on Friday mornings, we now do it on Thursday. And because we do that, I have one less day to watch things. And it's proving quite stressful. So I have an extra day to edit, but a day less to watch stuff. And I'm finding that a bit of a mixed blessing.
You're the one who wants us to do it on Thursday.
Oh, I'm very aware of that.
Let's just make that clear.
It's entirely hoist by my own Picard once again. So it's been a little bit tricky. So I will watch them, probably not both in the same week. I'll try and watch one next week, probably a shorter one. And then the other one after that. But what I do think we should talk about right now is the Ted Lasso finale. So there will be people listening to this who have not yet seen the second season of Ted Lasso, and people who are watching it who have not yet seen the finale. So for those of you who do not want to listen to us spoiling this, do feel free to skip ahead. I will put the timings in the description so that you can avoid all spoilers. For those of you Diamond Dogs still with us, however...
Oh my god. I'm not sure if even Alan Partridge should attempt that.
I can go full coach beard if I need to. That's absolutely fine. So I think we need to talk about Ted. And not just the finale, but the season as a whole. So what did you two think of season 2 of Ted Lasso, the formerly half-hour sitcom that has become a near hour-long drama?
Well, this to me now, and because it is an entirely different show. This feels like an entirely different show than the first season. The first season, to me, felt like a small group of creatives. No one was especially well known. I mean, Jason Sudeikis, you know, quite well known in like the comedy circuit, you know, did some SNL, did like things like 30 Rock, but wasn't like A-list caliber and is now getting like a million an episode for this. But it just sort of came out. I said it before about it. It was the tonic during a time when people needed affirmations, when they needed, you know, an abundance of love and care. And I just think they weren't anticipating this level of success whatsoever. And then it all came. And then I think all that's happened is Apple have said, you know, go, take all their money and go. And I think that's what's happened here. And it's become just a bit too conceptual for me and a bit too sprawling. What I liked about the first season was that there were just a few points to run with. So it was essentially Ted, his divorce, his mental health as a result of that divorce, and as we learned this season, something more deep-rooted. And then it was Rebecca's grudge against her ex-husband. So it was those core plot points with a little bit of football. That's what it was. And then all these marvellous characters got to kind of come out and grow and kind of be these works in progress that we got to see kind of evolve. And there's still works in progress this season. I like that. But it's just gone so conceptual and sprawling. There's still stuff in there that I love a lot. And we finally get to see more of that in the finale, I think. But I think they could have just cut down half of those storylines, half of those kind of ambitious kind of tears always. I didn't like, for example, the kind of Love Island subplot with Jamie Tartt, who, by the way, someone said I sound like on
Jamie
Twitter.
Jamie Tartt.
What?
Jamie Tartt.
Apparently, I've got a slight...
You sound like Jamie Tartt.
Someone
said
on Twitter.
Manchester.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. That's weird.
Yeah, no. Yeah, there's been some speculation about my accent on Twitter, which has been very funny to watch unfold. But yes, for example, I didn't like that kind of aspect of the show that came out. I didn't love the standalone coach episode. That might just be
me. Beard After Hours.
Beard After Hours. Yeah, I think it's a different show now. It's writing with a future in mind, whereas the other one wasn't quite as much. It's writing with legs. It's ended in a way that's very much building up to a third season, some of which I'm looking forward to seeing and some of which I could do without, to be honest.
Because it's that whole thing about how do you meet expectation? Because the first season came out in a vacuum, exactly as you say. They had no agenda. They were just whacking it out there. Let's see how it does. And now it's like, how do you follow on the show that became the patron saint of COVID? Like, how do you follow that on? And they went a little bit experimental at times. Bordy, what did you think?
I thought the finale was great. I really liked the finale. I thought the finale was a kind of a return to core Ted Lasso values, if you like. Because it was really funny and, you know, it had a football, it had a solid football element to it, which they always do very well. And, you know, I think I really liked the whole Ted anxiety storyline. I thought that was really good, the way they handled that. And I thought I was expecting more of a resolution to the Nick Mohammed's character, Nathan, storyline, because he's been the bell end of
this
the series.
Is my bugbear.
I'm fine with it. It's difficult to watch at times. I mean, in the previous episode, he spat in the mirror.
Oh, yeah.
When he was on that shopping trip.
Dark.
Which was dark.
Was
and
dark.
He is dark. He does go, and I think Nick Mohammed is brilliant in that role, by the way. Brilliant in the finale as well. But then the very last, literally the last shot sets up the next series. And I'm fine with that person. I think, you
he's
know.
Broken bad.
He's broken bad, right, he has. And I think he is one of the MVPs of the whole thing.
Yeah.
So I think the fact that he's going to play such a key role next season as a rival, clearly, because he's now at West Ham. You've done the spoiler, I think.
It's fine.
I didn't pay attention to that. I really like the finale. I thought that because I was expecting there to be a big scene with Nathan where, you know, he goes, look, I have terrible self-esteem issues.
Yeah.
I need to see a shrink. I'm really sorry. I thought that was going to be that kind of resolution.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
This show, I think it's very indicative of the fact this show doesn't ever, very, very rarely, resolve things in the way you expect it to. And that's my favourite thing about it. Favourite thing about it. Like, even when the shrink... when she'd gone without saying goodbye to Ted, and he got really annoyed with her. The way they resolved that was like they went on to the pub.
And
there's just a different way of doing things, which I think that is its kind of absolute the brilliant creative brilliance of the show is in finding ways to not be incredibly predictable. Because you know, the whole thing in a way is a series of romantic comedy kind of elements meets sports
rom-communism, if you will.
Rom-communism meets sports drama comedies, which always end up with a way of, you know, there being a big, you know, last minute. They did do the last minute penalty thing, but even that I thought was quite smart and clever the way they did that. So this long-winded way of saying I still think it's one of the best things on TV. I do agree with Beth completely about the one-off, the After Hours episode. I had issues with it. I just thought, everyone knows that they asked for 12 episodes, two extra episodes. And I think if you then do a one-off kind of gimmicky episode focused on the one character, which tonally is Maverick, and I admire... You know, I admire the idea about it and I admire the attempt to be bold and all that, use the B word, which I always use. But I thought I didn't enjoy watching it as much as I watched every other episode of the series. And I'm trying to think if there was another equivalent. There wasn't. That was the only kind of real episode that felt like a real, we're doing 12, we have to do something weird in the middle of it, like overly conceptual in the middle of it. So apart from that, I don't even mind. It has changed, and there is definitely more drama, and the episodes are longer. I'm even fine with that. I think that's great. I think you know, they're confident enough in the storytelling and having enough story and having enough characters. I thought Tohib Jimoh's character being wooed by the super rich guy and how that
resolves.
That was really funny and real. I thought that he would make that decision probably. So I'm waffling now, but I basically, bottom line, I still love it.
I do. It's like when you go to a fish and chip shop and you order fish and chips and they bring you an amazing burger and you're like, this is an undeniably lovely burger, but I came here for fish and chips. Where are my fucking fish and chips? And that's kind of how I felt going into this season. I like what they did. Even Beard After Hours, I thought it was bold. It was great. It had some batshit stuff in there. But I don't want that. That's not what I'm here for. Take this fucking burger away. I want some fucking fish and chips. And it didn't make me feel the feels I wanted. Like, I don't know if these guys have noticed, but the world is still on fire. Like, we're all still, our mental health is in shreds. Yeah. You know, I need a hug from Ted Lasso. Yeah. I need the buttery biscuits. I don't need the salty bitch, which he sort of which he turns up on the final day. I don't want that. I want the sweet buttery goodness. And I didn't get it. And I think that I felt cheated by that.
But the world cannot survive on sweet buttery biscuits alone.
Oh, but you say you that, Boyd. I believe it 100%.
Everything else isn't sweet buttery biscuits. That's what I'm saying. The entire world is a salty bitch, and this was our buttery biscuit. Yeah,
exactly.
And we're just piling onto the salty bitch.
But don't you think within one show, if the whole thing is that sweet, if the whole thing is relentlessly sweet, that you're going to get frustrated with it.
Yeah, and I think at any other time in human history, yes. But I think as we are in the year salty bitch, I think we can all take the buttery goodness all day long.
I don't agree.
And it'll just about keep us on an even keel.
I don't agree at all. I think I think you're a woke snowflake. No, I don't really. But what I do think is, I think it's exaggerated the extent to which we need comforting. Doesn't have to be comforting. You know, I mean, it just that's just bullshit. So,
but
I think this show still gave you incredible warm feels.
Yeah, it did. And
but
I think
I thought it incorporated a little bit of saltiness, particularly the Nick Mohammed storyline, really well.
Yeah, see, this is the bit I think that I bump on the most, the Nick Mohammed storyline. So Nate, I think, so Nick Mohammed's gift is just perfect, pitch perfect deadpan comedy. Like, he is so fucking funny, and all of that went, like, he wasn't funny at all, but deliberately, it's a deliberate turn. And all the way through, it just made you really uncomfortable because he was unpredictable. He was abusive, actually abusive.
Yeah.
And it just made you feel quite tense and anxious, which, as I've said, is just not what I want from Ted Lasso. But when this went on, like, the spitting in the mirror thing was dark. Like, the face-off he has with Ted is really dark. And I felt like we didn't really get the payoff, the explanation for why he's become this screeching bellend. Like, well, and yes, we can read between the lines. There's subtext. Yes, he has self-esteem issues, and he kind of talks about it a little bit when he talks to Ted. But it still doesn't quite ring true. Like, he was such a lovely...
The episode where he took his parents to dinner was really...
But that I thought was going to go in a different direction. I thought, okay, so he's gained his confidence. As I say, they're all working progresses, and I like that we see the workings. I like that we see how they become the people that they become. But it did seem to me like he was going to veer off in a different direction. I feel like, you're right, it doesn't resolve in the way that you're expecting. I still think that they need to show some of the repercussions that came with Nate. Even with Ted, who irked me a little bit this season, I'll be honest. Like, there's even a whole kind of... There's this terminology, toxic positivity, that's almost been born off the back of this show. Yeah. Like, he's not great in some of the episodes. Like, he really oversteps boundaries, especially with the counsellor, who apparently just calls up her patients. I'd love that if my therapist just called me up in the afternoon and been like, oh, right. saw you got a bit of hate on Twitter, you're right. Like, that's not how therapy works. But, like, just some repercussions to ground it a little bit more in reality. It just felt like it was making him a bellend for the sake of a third season in some instances. They were making him a bellend and not showing the workings and not showing the repercussions to draw out that storyline. Whereas I would have liked to have seen that sorted out a little bit earlier on.
I have a thematic question for you as well.
Oh, I'm terrible at maths.
What the fuck was going on with Nate's hair? Like, what was going on with Nate's hair?
Yeah, I agree with
Nate,
that.
Who got progressively greyer yeah. and greyer
yeah.
as the season went on, until he
that
had full
yeah.
white hair at the end. It's like, is this like when they turn to the dark side in Star Wars yeah. and like the dark side twists yeah. their form to evil?
I thought there was something wrong with my TV because it's true that often when you watch the unfinished episode,
yeah.
there are elements of it because you're watching it in like ultra HD.
Oh, so you thought his dark hair was CGI?
Yeah, I
think it was actually grey hair.
There's a weird CGI UHD issue with my TV where Nate's hair is like shiny, because often images on my TV are overly shiny, especially when I'm watching it on Apple. And I what's the word?
Compensate?
Stream it via Apple TV
yeah,
box.
Same here.
To my huge TV. So I thought there was an issue. But it must be deliberate. Yeah, it must be a symbolic
thing. They've not done the post-production on Nate's hair.
Yeah,
you know.
It must be some kind of, yeah, I was thinking, oh no, it's deliberate.
Yeah. It's weird though, isn't it? And no one references it. And it's just strange, isn't it?
Yeah. There's lots of shots because that final shot is the back of his head.
But I think that's to kind of throw you off a little bit. But
yeah.
It's, right. Oh, it's dreadful hair, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like I'm all for, and something I actually really loved about Mythic Quest is it started to show girls my age, women my age, with grey hair, with natural hair colours, which I would love to see more of in TV moving forward. And I thought that was very much what was happening here. But the whole thing is like it's a plot device, isn't it? It's like another means of like drawing the narrative. It's really weird. It's like he's becoming increasingly a villain because he's being awful. He's just being awful to everyone all the time.
They did it with Catherine Winnick as well, Lagertha in the final season of Vikings. There's a scene, and then when you see her again, her hair is just glacier white and no one ever mentions it and it's not a reference. And you're just like, am I going a bit mad? Like, what's happened here? Was that just really, really upsetting for her? But equally, I'm not sure hair works that way, doesn't it? Like, does it go from root to tip? I would have thought if it's going to go grey, it'll just grow grey at the roots, right? Yeah, the whole hair doesn't change colour.
I think we're not the best based people.
I mean, yeah, you're right. Me and you don't have to worry about
it. The question has to be a hair related.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that was very weird.
It was very strange.
Yeah.
Strange hair related choices.
I could talk about this all day, but Juno Temple.
Yeah,
and she's the...
Amber.
Everything about them I love, but I think she, like the way she dealt with Nate going in for the kiss, which could have been that.
Really
been,
believable as well.
Really believable.
Yeah. Really believable. And we'll get onto that, I think, later on in this show. It's a similar situation turns up in one of the shows we review. But again, it's that really awkward thing where there's been an unwanted amorous advance.
Yes.
And it's the intense awkwardness of how you deal with that situation.
I thought, again, what I love about the show, the way they deal with that and the way then Goldstein's characters. I always forget the names of the characters, by the way.
Roy.
He's here. He's there. He's every fucking where. Roy Kent.
No, I mean, we've got James chanting football chants. I mean, if only that achieved, that is a mutual achievement.
That's going to send my hair shocking white if he keeps doing the football chants.
This is what a great achievement. Ted Lasso, they've got you chanting.
Well, do you know why it resonated with me so much, Boyd? Because the only football match I have ever been to was indeed a Brentford game. So this took me all the way back to my youth when I saw is it the Bees?
Yes.
Yeah. When I saw the Bees play the little football game against someone else.
Brentford are just having a phenomenal season.
Well, I think when they like ninth division or something back in the 1980s when I saw them. And now they're like proper.
They're now practically top of the Premier League.
Yeah,
they're certainly above Arsenal. Shout out Juno Temple, phenomenal. And everything about her and Brett Goldstein together is fantastic.
Yeah.
I also loved Rebecca's romance with Sam.
I've come around to that after. I was not best pleased with that.
I mean, frankly,
but
there's a whole power dynamic workplace issue there.
Yeah.
But it's fine. It's fine. It's
again,
fine.
I think
it's an HR nightmare, but it's fine.
But what this series does is it takes those things that are judged, people judge.
Mm.
You know, I'm not saying you, but people judge people, other people for age inappropriate, whatever this. But, you know, I think this is a great kind of like...
It was handled very well.
Stop fucking judging us. This is a quite healthy...
Well. Yeah.
Actually, this is a healthy situation despite all of the HR implications and everything. I think it does those things so, so well that it doesn't stop... The writers aren't thinking what is the most appropriate way for us to deal with all these things. It's what is the most believable way that often flies in the face of established, if you like, kind of socio-political beliefs.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
No, I think you're right. Believable over. It is very believable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that was our little impromptu spoiler special for Ted Lasso Season 2. What other things have you people been watching?
You people.
What have you people been watching?
Well, I have to talk about, even though I really, really don't want to at this stage, just Squid Game. My whole week, I was saying to Boyd, just now, my whole week has been Squid Game. I had to do the review. I did the review for you guys, which meant I was about halfway through when I got asked to do it. So I had to finish it in an afternoon.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
About Squid Game. It's available, it's subtitled, obviously. Is there a dub? Is there a dubbed version?
There is a dubbed version.
Is the dubbed version subject to the same translation problems that the subtitles are?
I don't know. That's one thing I don't know. And I've written enough like news stories about this show this week. I've done like radio talks about this show this week. I've covered everything possible apart from whether you get the same meaning from the dubbed version as a subtitle. Because as we discussed in my review, there's a difference between the English and the English CC subtitles. You sent me the link, told me to include this in the review.
I know I did that, but I don't think I read the article particularly carefully.
Oh, I thought this was another. Yeah. Another.
Did I bet? I don't remember that.
No, soon in the show.
Yeah, it's a running gag now.
Told me this.
No. But I knew there were translation issues. And someone mentioned this on Twitter that it was a difference between the two different types of subtitles. So what you're saying, the closed caption ones are good?
No, English good, closed caption bad.
English good, closed caption bad.
I think that works generally for shows, because closed caption is like,
But it's not, closed caption's automated, isn't it, a lot of the time? Yes. Presumably not when it's Korean and it's got translated.
Yes. Yeah, so this is, so it's different, changes the meaning of some of the dialogue.
So you're actually okay if you're listening to the just English subtitles, or listening to, reading them.
Yeah.
listening to them.
I've noticed there's like moments where people say gosh a lot. People say gosh.
And you're like, are they really saying gosh?
There must be a better, no one says gosh, so you've got to find a better word for that than whatever than gosh. And that's in the mainstream English.
Right.
Yeah, golly. I just noticed that.
better in English. I mean, it is a phenomenon. I think it says a lot. I mean, we're talking about the year of the salty bitch. It says an awful lot about the world we're living in when you watch this show. I found it quite hard to watch. I did. I did a Five Live chat about it yesterday, and the presenter was saying how it's kind of cartoonish violence, which I can sort of get behind. It is like Tarantino sprays of blood, you know, it's very, very enhanced, but it is brutal. Like, it is people being shot at close range en masse. Like, the first game, I think it's about 200 people that are offed. Like, it is a lot to kind of take in, and it is relentless. There's still a lot of heart in it, but it's a lot. It's all that it says in my review.
It's a lot. Beth Webb, four stars.
It's a lot.
You're right. That violence is, it doesn't lessen it just because it's like probably obviously CGI blood even or whatever. Because you're right. It's, you know, we're used to the idea of one person shooting someone in the head, for example, at close range is a shocking moment. And then when you get dozens of people having that happening to them, that it is incredibly powerful. I was woken up at about 7:30, 7:40, listening to Five Live, and I heard Beth's voice talking about this. And I really was emerging out of sleep to reality.
But didn't you go to sleep listening to me? And then you woke up on the Empire podcast.
No, I'd already done that. And that's a once a week thing, listening to the Empire podcast late at night. But I have Five Live as my default, what I go to sleep to and wake up to.
Right.
So I was like, oh, wait a minute, I recognise that voice.
Are we Mancurian.
That's Jamie Tartt.
Yeah, it's Jamie Tartt doing a Pilot TV podcast review at 7:40 in the morning. It's really weird.
6:50
in the morning. It was 6, right, really early. Thank you. Yeah, there you go.
I was about to say, did you do it live? But it's kind of in the name, isn't it?
Do you know what they do? They repeated it as well.
Oh, did
not
they?
Not the whole bit, just a few of your observations, because they tend to do that an hour later.
Pretended they hadn't heard you said them like we do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Nikki Campbell goes, oh, you know, and we had a chat about this show before, and here's what our expert critic said, and then they played a bit of it again. So yes, it was disconcerting, never to say the least. But I've got up to episode, I haven't finished it yet, so I've got up to episode 6, and episode 6 is this legendary tug of war thing, which is one of the most powerful single episodes of anything for a long, long time. You have to watch this thing
I know.
I mean, at some point we either we should do a special where you finally watched it and deal with all the issues you're going to have to deal with.
Yeah, I am going to have to watch it.
It is a phenomenon. Like a South Korean broadband company sued Netflix because of the like surge of traffic they've had from people watching the show.
Yeah. But it's quite heartening, isn't it? Because ultimately, subtitle shows do alienate a certain percentage of the audience. The fact that people are able to overcome, Bong Joon-ho called it the 2-inch barrier. Like, you know,
love him.
It's like, but it is. Like, it is a barrier for those people who are slightly attention deficit or like to multitask, because you've got to focus. You can't just, you know, tip about on Twitter.
And I think what's really interesting, and I might have said this when I mentioned it the first time a couple of weeks ago, but forgive me, is that young people particularly, like in my niece and nephew's generation, like early 20s, are obsessed with this show, watching this show, and they're watching subtitles, and they're watching it with subtitles.
Yeah.
And I think that's like, and it's become, because it's on Netflix, I think that is the unique power of Netflix, I think. If this had been on Amazon Prime, for example, or even like BBC 4 or whatever, it just would not have had this impact. It wouldn't have had people of that, you know, 1989. I don't think it would have had 18, 19, 20-year-olds in their millions literally watching it and obsessing about it. That is the power of the cool brand that is Netflix, that it's making subtitled, quite difficult, challenging viewing as well, series in the foreign language.
Yeah.
Turned into the biggest cultural phenomenon of the moment. It is fucking unbelievable.
Yeah. Do you think it speaks to what that Netflix chap who you spoke to about the discoverability?
Ted Sarandos.
Was it Ted who told you this?
Ted Sarandos, yeah.
It's telling you about why they don't publicize some of this stuff. It just pops up.
Yeah, well, he said that. He has talked about that. And then another guy said that to me specifically, But he said that ages ago, that they've given up, you know, kind of trying to come up with like advanced what's the word I'm grasping for
reviews, notification, warning,
hype.
anti-hype.
So, you know, and this happened with this show.
That's a millennial concept of ever the world.
Yeah. So instead of hyping it up, so every other channel, pretty much, every other rival to Netflix, you know, no matter how much stuff content they've got, they will hype everything they've got.
Hype that show.
It's only any original, and Netflix does not do that, and they didn't do that with this. Like, I don't remember that any being told about this show at all on any level by anyone, which is unheard of in the world of TV and publicity.
Anti-hype.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I always get the impression that kind of Apple do that, but I'm not entirely sure it's intentional.
I agree. Yeah, exactly. I think that is the difference. Yeah.
Like, they have amazing stuff and they just kind of forget to tell you about
and
it.
And they're incredibly, what's the word, protective about with their weekly embargo dates and you're allowed to review the whole thing in one go, blah, blah, blah.
Anti-hype. I quite like that idea. And I do think, I like that Christmas morning idea that people would turn on Netflix and they just have no fucking clue what's going to greet them every time they fire it up.
The greatest show of all time, The OA, arrived as a surprise drop, season one. One of the greatest experiences of my life was watching that pretty much in one.
And people had to wait 45 minutes to find out what the show was called. So.
Exactly, yeah. The power of that. And I remember talking to the creators about it, and they were like, yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah, it's incredibly rewarding to have something that feels like a pure word of mouth.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, Squid Game.
So, Beth's been watching Squid Game.
Yeah, me too. I haven't finished it, so I've got 3 more episodes to go. Blair Brown, the new Labour revolution, which I mentioned last week.
Yes, I heard good things about this.
So, I've watched all of that. That's all on iPlayer now. It goes out on Mondays. I think the first episode went out last Monday. The second episode will be today if you're listening to this. But it is like a. Because I lived through this, fascinated by politics anyway. So to be there, to having lived through it in the 90s when New Labour became a thing and the Tony Blair and Gordon Brown thing, but as I said a couple of weeks ago, the best thing about it is you've got the two of them on the record being interviewed now about these extraordinary things that happened and the unbelievable viciousness. So at one point, the most famous I think is in episode 2, basically they started out as being two guys in a basement who coming together and they have a brilliant bromance between them, and they kind of, you know, there was some kind of great affection and inspiration between the two of them. And then by the time Tony Blair became Prime Minister, certainly for the second term, they just fucking hated each other. And the people who worked for Tony Blair and the people who worked for Gordon Brown hated each other even more and were constantly undermining each other. And there was a famous moment where someone in Blair's people basically said that Brown was psychologically flawed, had psychological flaws, and that became a huge story everywhere. And it's always been assumed it was Alistair Campbell. And he kind of denies it, but kind of doesn't a bit in the show. But I thought that moment alone was fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, just to kind of attack someone's mental health effectively for political reasons shows how low it got. And there's just constant constants, and just the two of them kind of, Tony Blair a lot of the time just going, yeah, there's no other way of doing it apart from just being ruthless, and I was the ruthless one, and Gordon Brown wasn't as ruthless, and it's just absolutely fascinating. Wow. It's proper drama,
yeah.
You know, political drama, and we are reviewing a political drama later.
Yeah.
It's interesting contrast between the two.
Yeah.
Mm.
No, I'm quite interested to see that. It's obviously great. I'll have to watch it after it's I watch so Gilmore Girls, and It's Always Sunny / Funny in Philadelphia. So.
Yeah. I didn't watch my episode of It's Always Sunny either, by the
okay.
way.
Oh, good. I don't feel so bad now.
I've also generally been distracted by Seinfeld, obviously.
So yes,
Seinfeld
is now like a nightly.
I love this. Oh, yeah, I watch it. It's not like you don't have the whole thing on DVD. So.
No, I know. And I've watched the whole thing many, many, many times. But there is a joy to having it just like there streaming and, you know, just constantly.
You just have it on all the time.
Oh, they've won, haven't they, Netflix?
I mean, it's kind
they've
of default,
just won. Yeah.
It is incredible how undated it is, how little it has dated.
Yeah.
I mean, it has in terms of the way it's made.
Isn't George Costanza supposed to be like 33? Like,
yeah, he was.
Terrifies me.
He was, yeah. Oh, yeah, he was. I mean, he basically looked the same, you know. He was bald, and there's loads of great bald stuff throughout the whole thing. One of the great things, his baldness is a key element of his personality, like created by Larry David, for whom the same goes. But in terms of like the dialogue and the kind of, I mean, there are moments where attitudes towards, you know, sexuality and gender, those things are
that's era related.
But even then, less than a lot of other things I've watched. But just the wit of the dialogue and the characters just sitting there in the coffee shop just talking shit to each other. Those moments they have not dated at all. They are just fantastic. So, yeah.
So, like, if you're watching it all the time, like, when you're talking to someone now, if there's a lull in conversation in your head, you hear the bass line.
And also, I forgot that season 3, which is the place where, and you can start because series 1 and 2 aren't that great, apart from the odd episode, begins, they decided to remix that theme tune, and they added a choric bit with women going,
Oh my God.
It's excruciating. And then they ditched it after the episode. Clearly someone went, that is fucking awful, you idiots.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
That is spectacular.
What about you, James? What have you been watching?
What have I been watching this week? Oh, see, now I realise I've now backed myself into a corner because if I say anything...
You're watching other stuff.
If I say I've been watching anything, I'm kind of instantly in trouble.
Yeah.
But I have been watching other things. Because it gets to the point where I just want to watch something nice and calming and relaxing.
Gilmore Girls is like...
And just like happy and joyous. So I've been catching up on The Walking Dead. So
I can't look at
it's been fantastic. Like,
but I'm tish.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, but genuinely, so the thing that I got so excited about this season is seeing Maggie and Negan together and the dynamic. Lest we forget, Negan bashed Maggie's husband's brains in with a barbed wire wrapped baseball bat. It's kind of hard to come back from that. But watching those two together and this kind of truce between them has been fascinating. I have loved every second of it. They should be on screen together all the time. It's really, really interesting. They have a particular conversation over a campfire, which is fucking brutal. Like, it is truth bombs detonating left and right. It's really, really good. I mean, yes, admittedly, like this season, certainly they've introduced a sort of, I was about to say it's a B plot. It's actually pretty much the A plot. And then the main one is the B plot and will, I think, become the A plot. But, you know, they deviated from the comics a little bit to give certain characters more to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, okay, it's bad group of people in a community go to war with our particular bad people in the community and they have a fight. Like, that's the format of basically The Walking Dead in general. But it is strangely gripping and it's tied back in a number of places to those kind of Walking Dead special bonus episodes that we got at the end of last year, which was great. Mm. So I was really excited about that. So I'm very much keeping up with my Walking Dead. And spoiler for the news section, but Jeffrey Dean Morgan was saying there was some early talks about some sort of Negan spin-off series, which I am absolutely
He's
here for.
He's been talking about this for a while.
I mean, it's not going to happen, is it?
Also, how many more spin-offs do we need from the fucking
Admittedly, but if there's a Here's Negan series, I'm definitely watching it. That's just what I'm going to say to you. But yeah, no, that's basically all I watched this week, was just caught up in Walking Dead because I've been a little bit behind. Been a bit remiss, I had. I thought that would be fun. Right, well, that's obviously what we've been watching. So let's move on to this week's listener question. And this week's question comes from Brendo at Green Brendo. Since this week's, meaning last week's, podcast was like you all had your minds wiped, well, all except Beth, what are the best amnesia uses in a TV show? Now, I'm not saying this is actually a great question, but I liked that it had...
just sing this poem.
But I liked that it had thematic resonance.
Yeah, it was a timely piece. I mean, also, are there actually any good uses of amnesia? easier interview. I find it such a lazy plot device.
Oh, it's terrible. It's genuinely terrible.
It's so bad.
It is so lazy. And I think nowhere is that better exemplified than in season one of 24, where Terry Bauer, they realise they have fucking nothing to do with her. Like, what are we going to do with her? We're going to have a car crash. She's going to lose her memory for a bunch of episodes, just wander randomly around the countryside bumping into things. And they thought that was a good plot. And then just to double down on it, they ended up with the cougar in the season after, because they have Kim pursued by a cougar for several episodes or whatever. It's madness. But yeah, that particular Jack Bauer's wife subplot is truly dreadful. But yeah, I mean, genuinely, can you think of a good use of amnesia anywhere?
The only one I can think of as Buffy was Tabula Rasa, where they all, and that's essentially a fan service, but they all wake up and Buffy can't remember how to fight, and Giles and Anya think they're married.
I'd forgotten all about
that. Yeah. Well, I had to do some digging, to be honest, because also the episodes with amnesia, and I hadn't watched any of them. I just hadn't watched them, so I'd gone a bit of a deep dive. And Buffy was the best one I could think of. Because it just wipes the slate clean for a lovely contained episode where you get to see all these kind of dreamed up scenarios between them. You know, what if? It was like a Buffy what if. And Giles and Anya in that. I mean, Giles and Anya are my favourites anyway, but Giles and Anya are now thinking that they're married and actually having really incredible chemistry together was really, really great. Before he went off and bought West Ham.
Yeah, well, yeah, indeed. I was going to say, you have complicated feelings about Ripper Giles whenever you see Ted Lasso.
Yeah, there's a really good two-part episode of Doctor Who, which is called Human Nature, featuring David Tennant's Doctor. And the idea of it was that what would happen if the Doctor ends up in the past, just in England, and he kind of has his self-imposed amnesia, where he doesn't know he's the Doctor, and he's just a normal guy, if you like. But he has kind of dreams of this heroic figure who does travel through time and space, or does something similar, and has these amazing adventures. And that's a really good idea of that Paul Cornell wrote that story. And I remember loving that two-part and kind of the way he explored this idea that he can't remember what he's turned himself into. Means he can't remember, because of his new persona, who's called John Smith, by the way. He can't remember that he is the Doctor, and that I thought was great. The Sinner series one was pretty much entirely about amnesia.
I'd forgotten that. That's an amazing one.
Yeah, so that's the best.
That's the best. Yeah, hands down.
Because it completely...
Oh, so good.
Yeah, it's so brilliantly done.
Yeah.
And I think The Sinner season one is underrated in terms of just...
It's amazing.
A brilliant premise.
Yeah.
Jessica Biel is unbelievably good in it.
Yeah.
And the resolution was so kind of... completely believable and plausible.
And so horrific as
and
well.
And horrific at the same time, you're right. Yeah, the flashback to the resolution of what happened to cause her to not remember this stuff is so interesting. And the whole religious kind of cult element that they weave in.
Yeah.
It was a brilliant, brilliant series. So that would be my big vote. And kind of Life on Mars, Ashes to Ashes, that whole thing relied on amnesia to some extent.
Well, it was more sort of altered perception, wasn't it? It wasn't much amnesia.
But The Sinner, for sure.
Yeah.
And there was a show called Amnesia, I remembered, as I was researching this, which Chris Lang wrote of Unforgotten fame and starred John Hannah and Gemma Redgrave. And it was about John Hannah's character is a cop whose wife disappears on their fifth wedding anniversary. And it's literally called Amnesia. And it was a two-part on ITV 2004, which I don't remember, I have to admit. But now I'm I really want to get a hold of it and watch it because it looks quite funny. And if you look at it on Wikipedia, the pack shot, the cover of the DVD release is so funny. It's literally John Hannah looking up into space, kind of going, I'm amnesiac.
Looking a bit lost.
I'm a bit amnesiac, or am I? I don't know. Someone is. Yeah. So there you go.
Oh, see, I don't have an amnesia, but Absentia is very much geared around amnesia. And that's a series. I guzzled that, I think, pretty much in like a week or so, or a week or two. I got really into that. It was quite compelling. But yeah, that's hinged around. I think Blind Spot is another one. I don't watch it, but Blind Spot's another amnesia.
It's 100%. That starts with him in Times Square.
Yeah, right? And with tattoos and whatnot. And okay, so that's kind of themed on that. I mean, I feel like when you're in a sort of science fiction thing, I swear to God, if you threw a tricorder in any direction, you'd hit eight different episodes of Star Trek, which revolve around amnesia. But just to pick a couple, there's the one where Data ends up on a planet and they think he's some kind of frost giant because he's got amnesia, if an android can have amnesia.
He's the measure of a man.
It's definitely not the measure of a man, but it's definitely not that one, but yes, that is Data. I can't remember what that one's called, actually. It's to thine own self or something. It's some quote from something. Anyway, so there's that one, and then there's the one where the whole whole of the Enterprise gets amnesia. They all wake up and no one knows who anyone is.
Oh, yeah, what?
And there's a new person who's not a member of the crew pretending to be a member of the crew, and we're all like, it's him! Oh, we don't know who he is. He's not Riker.
That episode. Yeah,
yeah, and it's because these aliens have taken over the ship. They've given them all amnesia to try and get them to kill another race of people. Right. So that's pretty bad. Farscape had a kind of thank God it's Friday again episode where everyone gets amnesia. It's fucking terrible. The other thing I would bring up is Babylon 5, obviously, which we talked about on the last episode.
Yeah.
But the reason I'm going to bring it up is Babylon 5 has a very interesting take on the death penalty. Mm-hmm. So in Babylon 5, instead of executing people, they give them the death of personality, which is essentially like a process-induced amnesia, where it just, the whole personality is essentially sucked out their ears.
That's a good idea.
And they become...
boys getting some thoughts.
They are reprogrammed to love serving others. So they don't have anyone in prison. They just suck out their personality and they become essentially slaves. I mean, the ethics of that is questionable.
What was that really expensive Netflix show? It had a similar thing with the body was just a vessel for...
Oh, altered carbon.
Altered carbon,
yeah. With sleeves. Yeah, so that was consciousness being transferred to different sleeves.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, which is good. I really liked altered carbon.
Of course you did.
Yeah, it was brilliant. And
everyone else
was
like bored to death.
It was great! It was great, because we had Anthony Mackie for season two. He was brilliant.
Oh, yeah, it was season two.
Yeah, that's right. And Joel Kinnaman was the same. Takeshi Kovacs.
Naked Kinnaman.
That's right. Yes, there were cocks everywhere, weren't there?
Yeah, flopping around.
It really was. Yeah, it was a great old big willy fest. But it was good. It was good. Like that. Also carbon. What else is there? Probably loads of stuff, but I think we've had enough. But probably loads of stuff, but I've forgotten.
So
if you have a question to ask us, then do feel free to send them to us. You can send them to @PilotTVPod via DM on Twitter or Instagram if you like. It's entirely up to you. Or send them direct to me @JamesCDyer. Right. Shall we move on to news?
Yes.
Oh, I don't want to, because I know what we're going to have to talk
Shall
about.
Shall we move on?
I've seen the tweet.
Really? I haven't. What tweet?
Well.
Oh, I missed this.
Well, Boyd.
This is like when you accidentally remind your teacher that you did get set homework.
Oh, God.
And,
what is it?
Well, so Boyd, there was a trailer this week for Game of Thrones House of the Dragon, which over the next 4 to 5 hours, I shall break down frame by frame.
Yeah. But oh, tweet by James, you mean? No, I thought
this is the part where you can both switch off and do other things.
Okay, I'm just gonna...
what did you guys think of it? Tell me, speak to me.
I mean, it was like Game of Thrones.
Yeah, it was exactly like
what
Game of Thrones.
What do you want?
But someone, and I can't remember who, made the very good observation on Twitter. I think it might have been someone like a clever writer type person. So stylistically, the world doesn't change hundreds of years, and everyone looks the same as they did in Game of Thrones, even though it's set, 200 or something years before? I thought that was an interesting point, because
the fashion hasn't changed.
Yeah, the fashion, look, just generally.
So you wanted them to walk around like Targaryens in flares and like hairy chests with like dragon medallions hanging out. They've got
some
disco
kind of
fever.
That time fashion changes.
Oh, I would pay to see that. Like 80s themed Game of Thrones with like shoulder pads and massive hair.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Other than that, it was exactly what I expected, I think.
Yeah.
You know, if you'd have said, this is the thing, so 20 years before, about the sect, the family, the tribe that has the dragons.
Yeah.
And there's glimpses of dragons.
Yeah.
And it's going to be all about fucking dragons.
Yeah.
And I think, because I feel like what I loved about Game of Thrones right from the start was that it was a show really about medieval history and power games, which, you know, the creators made clear, with dragons.
Yeah.
But the dragons were always like just the with bit. It was the medieval power games that made it brilliant.
Yeah.
Whereas this time, I'm completely open-minded. Of course, I'm excited about it, but there was nothing in the trailer that led me to think, this is going to be an amazing surprise, and nothing like I expected.
Yeah. I mean, it was a teaser, so it's short, isn't it? It's short. Yeah. So, Beth, tell us what you thought as well.
Yeah, no, well, I agree with Boyd. I mean, I'm at a nice phase, and I'm sure you're going to ruin this, but I'm at a nice phase where I know that things go wrong for the Targaryens. I can't remember specifically why. And someone drew a really good comparison to this and Better Call Saul, where you know it's a tragedy, you know what's going to happen, but you get kind of drawn into this world regardless. So I'm interested in that respect, and I hope to try and avoid what happens, or remind myself of what happens to the Targaryens. I just know it doesn't end fucking well. So I'm going to try and enjoy this for all I can. I'm excited about the cast. I think Matt Smith is a great choice for this. Mm. I really love Olivia Cooke. I think she's a fantastic young actor, and I think she will fit very well into that world. I think she has quite a dark role from what she said in interviews. So I think she gets to be a bit of a slippery snake. And Paddy Considine and Reese Evans, I think, will be great as well. But yeah, it is just more of the same. I just hope it's kind of learnt from its mistakes from the last season, is all I'll say.
Well, that's a whole other 17-minute monologue, which I won't deliver again here. But the thing that a lot of people are saying is, you know, the Game of Thrones went off the boil when it kind of strayed away from the books. And, you know, the thing with this is it's based on a book, Fire and Blood, which is George R. R. Martin's History of the Targaryen Dynasty, essentially. But this is the Dance with Dragons. So it's the civil war that's kind of rifts the Targaryen house in two.
Yeah.
And the thing about the book is it's not a novel. It is weird. It's a fantasy history book. It is literally just a history textbook about the Targaryen. So, I mean, you're not wrong.
It's quite boring.
I mean, it is. It's really fucking dry.
All those appendices to the Lord of the Rings. Like,
well, no, but it's, yeah, basically that. It's like a great big whopping massive book that reads like one of your history textbooks. So I struggled. I can't be honest. I struggled with it. And this is me. So, but what I guess I'm getting at is that it's not, like they're making this shit up. They do have an outline for the political plotting of this.
Right.
So, like, George R. R. Martin's mythology is at the heart of this.
It's all made up, James, by the way.
Shush. This is all true. It's a documentary. Now, but what it doesn't have is the personality. And I suppose watching that trailer, like, I can see, like, you know, you've got your character. So you've got Paddy Considine as King Viserys the First, and you see him with his Valyrian steel sword Blackfyre in it, which is kind of cool. And that's great. And he's like a good king. And his daughter, who is Princess Rhaenyra Targaryen. So, like, he wants her to kind of succeed him onto the throne.
Right.
But of course, you know, it's all a bit patrilineal. They don't really like that kind of thing. Nevertheless, I think she's the only child, so that can happen. However, Alicent Hightower, who is Olivia Cooke, and you see her holding the dagger, which looks like the dagger from Game of Thrones in this, which is kind of cool.
I believe she
marries King Viserys.
I don't want to hear all this though. Can I not fine. Just watch it in the show?
But I'm just saying. Look, so this is the setup for the show. So
it's all happening
this, that, and the other, and then you've got creepy Uncle Damon, which is Matt Smith. The less said about his relationship with characters, the better.
Yeah, like the less said about most of this, the better. All right,
fine.
Oh my
fine.
God! This is a dagger to his heart.
See,
this
is what he does. A Valyrian steel dagger to my heart. So I can't tell you about Steve Toussaint, the sea snake Corlys Velaryon.
You could tell me about why I should be excited about this, having never read the books and will never read the books.
Guns don't kill people, dragons do. I'm a fucking dragon and I'm going to kill you.
Oh my God, that was incredible.
What, there's no room for godly looking Jane on this podcast?
I mean, it was a bit like, you know, someone from Succession. What's his name from Succession?
Oh my rapping. God.
Kendall.
I've gone full Kendall Roy.
As well as Alan Partridge, you're also the Kendall Roy of this podcast.
I'll take
as well.
That. I'll take yeah. that.
If you create your own rap, I think if you do the whole thing in rap, then it'll be fine. Then we won't mind, you know, you're
fine.
Ruining it.
I'll do my best. Okay, fine. I won't tell you this story.
Don't tell me the entire story, though. Right. No. Could you not tell me the entire story?
I don't know how we're going
to
fill the rest
really
of the podcast.
I'm not paying attention. I just have to let it wash over you. It's all just nonsense. Just you'll forget it all.
Okay, the sort of TLDR version of what this is basically that I'm here for the plot and the story arc and the dynastic politics of it. My worry is without the very detailed character work that Martin did in A Song of Ice and Fire, that these characters on paper, none of them feel like they have the kind of idiosyncratic appeal of like a Tyrion Lannister or a Varys or a Littlefinger. That's not to say they will not have. They absolutely may do, and I am absolutely
how can you
not
tell from the 92nd or everyone.
Well, no, but it's exactly that. But just based
because George R. R. Martin hasn't, well, yeah, just established them.
But not just that, but just knowing the sort of broad outlines of the characters from the sort of broad outline book.
Yeah,
like they don't seem as instantly interesting as some of the Song of Ice and Fire characters. But that doesn't mean they won't be. And also, Miguel Sapochnik is kind of like running the show, and he did some of the greatest Game of Thrones action that we've seen on screen. So I do think this will be pretty awesome. It's going to turn up next year, and you know, brace yourselves. You remember our old segment? Oh, you won't remember, boy, because you remember nothing that we do on the show. But you remember Here Be Dragons, where we did our sort of like Game of Thrones spoiler specials at the end of each episode.
We
should totally do that again every episode of this.
Who had never watched it, she suddenly got really excited about it,
and then stopped.
She watched it season six onwards.
that's such a Terry Manina.
Yeah.
I'm Terry fucking White, and I'm going to watch this from season six onwards.
No, but she didn't. Like, she came in at the final season. She hadn't watched anything before, and she watched every episode up till the finale, missed the finale, then never went back to it. And that in itself is classic Terry.
That is absolutely perfect. I think I saw somewhere, and I hope this is wrong, that it's coming in January, and I really hope, like, early January.
It's not.
Somewhere
it's not.
On Google.
It's like, it's not.
It's not. It's not. It's not coming in January. It will be next
James
year.
Over your Google.
But it's not January.
Yeah. Did you see there was a very funny news story where there were loads of complaints from a Cornish holiday camp because the filming kept disrupting holiday campers in Cornwall.
All the dragons were, like, scaring
off the
tourists.
All the filming and things was going on from, like...
They could get in the way.
Yeah. So they bought them all those hampers at this little happy camp holiday camp.
Oh, that's nice. That's
very sweet.
Yeah, that's very sweet. Was it filmed all in? Is it filmed all in Britain? Then was it? Or the mostly?
Oh, I hope so.
Oh, all over the place. I think it's shot in lots of different places. But yes, it did. It did shoot here as well.
HBO know what they're doing, though, don't they? They've got, you know, that's going to be fucking gigantic, isn't it?
They need it to be, quite frankly.
Do they? I think they're all right TV wise. They're fine.
No, but I mean in terms of the future of Game of Thrones as a franchise, because they have big plans for this world.
Of course, sure.
Yeah. And I'm not going to start this by saying the, you know, if only George R. R. Martin had big plans to finish novels, but I'm not going to start that. I'm not
I love
that.
His, like, he's like, yeah, I see what you want. I'm going to do a graphic novel. There's nothing to do with any of this.
It's so funny. Like, all the Game of Thrones fans are like bleeding out of their ears. He's like, yes, I've just commissioned a new comic series. And they're like, it's been 10 years, George. It's been 10 years.
Now, if you're him, like, aren't you sitting there going, well, I mean, they finished it for me. Like, what's the point? It's all been done. It's over.
It's been finished.
The story has been resolved.
Mm. Yeah. But then all of the
gonna do?
All like the final season haters will be like, George, save us, write us a proper ending.
I just think it's like, if I was him, and I think, you know, I think this is an insight into his current psychology, you'd be like, I don't know why I bother.
I'm done. Yeah. I'm bored now.
It's done.
I'm going to do graphic novels. Yeah. And he's got a computer game coming out next year.
Of course
it's like, George? What are you doing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Someone is going to kidnap that man and like tie him to a word processor misery style and make him fucking finish this series. It might be me.
Like the series you. You could have him in a basement in a glass.
He may be there even now in a glass box in my basement.
Yeah. Talking of glass, have you heard about Sky Glass?
Oh, that's a great segue, Boyd.
Lovely.
That is a great segue.
I haven't, but I'm here for this segment.
Yeah. So Sky Glass, I think, is a potential massive theme because...
Yeah, I agree.
This was announced today. This is Thursday when we're recording this. And it's basically at hardware. So it's a TV set. It's glass, but it's instead of having when you buy a TV set, you then have to either decide whether you're going to have a satellite dish to get Sky Q, et cetera, and a box that you need for Sky Q, et cetera, or an Now TV box. You don't need anything. It's all just the thing, just literally the glass fronted TV monitor. And the Sky stuff, all the platforms, Netflix, Amazon Prime are all included in it. If you pay the right price, and there's no other boxes and nothing to sign up to, it's really interesting.
Good
but
Lord.
This is something. Now, my understanding is that they trialed dishless Sky. Is it in Germany? Certainly in Europe last year. Mm. So this is not a new thing. It's just not come to the UK yet. Because I mean, I do feel like satellite dishes do feel a little bit archaic at this stage.
Yeah, yeah.
So they were doing sort of over the internet Sky as distinct from Now. And how they're going to gel that with Now, I really do not know. But they were doing that because obviously Now, which is Sky but over broadband, but doesn't have everything that Sky has, like sort of live broadcast recording, all the PBR stuff that Sky Q has. And I don't think it has everything that's on Sky Q. And the reason I say that because I've read it somewhere, so it must
has
be true.
All the Sky. It has all of Sky's content,
but just not everything you get on the Sky service.
Does.
As a Now ambassador, Boyd, I would really expect you to know the answer.
You're really testing me now. But the main thing about Now is you don't have to sign up to. It's not a long term. A long term contract.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a contract free.
It's more. Like, I mean, it is more convenient. I have to be honest with you.
So I think with this, it is still like you still. They're hoping that you sign up to the long term. I think you can get it anyway without all the different things. But they're hoping you sign up to the long term contract in which you get Disney Plus, Amazon Prime, Netflix, iPlayer, and Now. As part of this whole thing, and without needing any other hardware, my one observation though about this whole thing, I think it's fascinating and interesting, and I think it's like the kind of what Apple has been doing. You know, there are rumors of an Apple branded television set for years, and they haven't actually done it yet. But it's almost feels like what they're supposed to do, because the other thing about it is the idea is you switch it on, and it's show led. and it's kind of recommending shows that you might like, Led. But it's also, so say there's a show that, you know, with half of it, season one's on Amazon Prime, season two and three are on iPlayer. Mm. It'll seamlessly let you watch it all wherever the fuck it's actually based. So that is quite clever.
Yeah.
That is clever. And they've got the agreement of all those different people to make that, you know, possible. But the main thing I noticed, the size of the screen, the maximum size of the screen available, like pretty much now in the UK, is 65 inches. And I'm sorry.
That's not big enough for you, boy.
It's not big enough for me. And that's a fundamental error. When you've got a 78 incher, as I do, you're not going to go back anything less than that, are you? I mean, it's ridiculous. So they've just miscalculated. You need a humongous big set.
That is disgusting, boy. I mean, who in their right mind could watch on a smaller than 65 inch TV? It's just disgusting.
But they're aiming it. But I have a semi serious point, which is that this is clearly aimed at TV obsessive.
Boyd, I should have break this to you. You are the only person in the world with a 78 inch television. In the world.
I can't even fathom what
their
that
80 is bigger. They're 80 and 82 as well, by the way.
Goodness.
I mean, 78 is nothing.
No one has a 78 inch TV. They do. Anyway. Oh.
Yeah, I think they miscalculated. They need to have one bigger. Okay. 75 would have been fine.
100. Why go for 100?
Oh, there are cool 100 ones. Yeah, there absolutely are 100 ones.
Jumbotron.
But up. But what's interesting is I'm reading this story on Variety and they misspell Nickelodeon to Nice Clodion. I'm just going to call it Nice Clodion from now on.
Oh, Nice Clodion.
Yeah. Autocorrect strikes again.
On a 65-inch TV.
That's very funny. Yeah. That's very funny. But yeah, but this is an interesting thing, I think, twofold. Having like dishless Sky, I think. But then it's how is this going to work with like tariffs? Because the difference obviously between Now TV and Sky in terms of cost, I think, is not insignificant.
Yeah.
So, but then it doesn't now works differently, isn't it? Because now you can either buy entertainment or cinema or sport or all three. Yeah. Like you have options, isn't it?
Yeah. Monthly.
And they're about like a tenner each, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. Something like
so
that,
it's like it'd be like a tenner for entertainment.
You can buy individual things on any given day.
And then
you watch the football live all of a sudden.
Yeah.
You can pay for that and you watch it there.
Yeah. But it's broadly speaking, it's like a tenner per package,
yeah,
isn't it? And then there's Boost as well, isn't it? What's Boost, Boyd?
I don't know.
You're an ambassador, Boyd. You should know what Boost
that
is.
It says the television, the Sky Glass thing, will only be available to purchase with a Sky Network package totaling £39 per month for the smallest screen.
Whew.
Yeah, which breaks down as £13 per month for the screen and £26 for the Sky Carriage package.
See, that sounds a lot, but if it includes Netflix and Amazon Sky, that's actually not bad at all.
Exactly, yeah. Oh, wait a minute. Users will, however, have to pay for their own subscriptions to each streamer.
Oh, so it doesn't include any of that.
Okay.
Except where they purchase a Sky package that includes Netflix. So it's very complicated.
I'm very confused.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you know.
That's confusing.
Yeah.
But the takeaway from this is that dishless Sky is coming, and that's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
There you go.
All
good.
Right.
Great. Good.
Thrilled.
Thrilled.
Thrilled, she says.
Oh, dear.
What else have we got? What else has happened this week? Were you excited, both of you, to hear that Bailey Bass, or Bailey Bass, I don't know how you pronounce it, is going to play Claudia the Vampire in AMC's Interview with the Vampire TV show?
I don't know anything about this.
I mean,
I don't know who that is.
It's pretty much that in the headline.
Okay.
I don't know who it is either.
Okay.
But she's going to play Claudia. Claudia's a little girl vampire. Kirsten Dunst in the film.
I like the film. Okay. I like Kirsten Dunst in the film.
See, it's not just me, Boyd. People do like the film.
Oh, I like the film. I like the film. That's almost like you didn't listen when I said I like the film.
almost like we don't listen. Almost.
Yeah.
I love how everyone's like second guessing themselves now.
Yeah.
I think I might have said this a few weeks ago, and you might have said this anyway. And we've probably all said this already, but I'm going to say it again also, and I apologise. Cancel culture, go on.
Vigil is officially the UK's most watched new drama in 3 years.
Beth is also public enemy number one.
Me?
Because Beth said in last week's podcast and was castigated for this on our social media, she mentioned that Martin Comston dies in Vigil, which apparently makes you a terrible person, even though it happens in the first 5 minutes of the first episode of the fucking series.
I completely missed this on social media.
To be fair,
and I probably will.
No, I think the person who called you out, to be fair to them, I think they've been saving the box set to watch, so they don't know.
Okay.
Like, there always could be a show about Martin Comston. Spoiler, it isn't. He does die very early.
He does die very early.
Very early.
But it was when the episode went out, BBC was like, please don't tell anyone that Martin Comston dies in the first episode.
Fair enough.
Made that as a,
but it is the first five minutes of the first episode.
It's not 5 minutes. I debate that. I think it's longer than that into it. But
it's
very much around Jones is the lead.
Definitely in the first.
Yeah. And she doesn't come into the show until after he dies.
Yeah, that's true.
So, because she's literally there to investigate his murder.
Yeah, but anyway. Fair enough.
Anyway, it's the most watched show for a whole new bunch of people.
If we hadn't spoiled it enough last week, we've now ruined it for everyone else. So, there you go.
But here was the power of it, that it, you know, obviously comes from Gemma Curio's production company, etc. Yep. Actually, the people who make Bodyguard and Line of Duty. But 13.4 million people watched that first episode in the end, including. Which is fucking
despite
massive.
Beth ruining it.
Despite Beth ruining it. That is fucking huge, I have to say. And the fact, did you see in a bracket, so I meant to mention this last week, but someone, there was a story in one of the tabloids saying that, oh, Bodyguard season two is going to happen finally.
Oh, really?
You know, and the, everyone's got their, you know, their, what's the phrase when you've got everything aligned? Everyone's
stars aligned
or whatever.
Something.
But then Gemma Curio went on immediately, was like, you are talking fucking shit on Twitter, basically. I paraphrase and denied it massively completely and said, there's no confirmation at all yet. It's bullshit. But it's fascinating how that has not happened.
How has that not happened?
Bodyguard, the biggest, more than Line of Duty itself, the biggest drama of the last 20 years, I believe, on TV, has not had a second series yet and has not even been confirmed as having a second series yet. It is fucking amazing.
Kind of respect that.
Do you think it's because, like, the story they wanted to tell, they kind of told?
No.
No? You don't think it's like a lack of an idea?
No. They I guarantee you, Gemma Curio has got the story for the second series totally established in his head. He may even have written it. This is conjecture on my
part. Then what's he doing? It's him and fucking George R. R. Martin. They can both be in my basement by next week, I tell you.
But I remember him saying, like, a year after the first series, that it's hard to get, what's his name, you know...
Richard Madden.
Madden from Game of Thrones, because he's so busy and he's been doing loads and loads of other things. And he was doing all these big movies, doing Hollywood movies. He's got another big thing coming out.
He's in the Eternals.
Eternals.
That's the one I was thinking of. So it was partly that. So it's getting all the different the talent together, the right people. So I think it's mostly that. And I think he won't. And then he also wants to do more Line of Duty, blah, blah, blah. But I guarantee you there will be that he wants to do another series. 100%. Because it's not even, there's been way more limited series that clearly ended their stories that have been gratuitously continued.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just a character of the Bodyguard itself and the Home Secretary and all of that is, you know, that could go on for many series. Line of Duty series.
I mean, less so with the Home Secretary.
No spoilers.
but I feel I'd be too scared to ask Jed if he's working on the sequel to that, lest he flamey alive.
I think someone did, didn't they, in one interview in the round of interviews he did for, he did a comic graphic novel, didn't he?
Yesterday.
And he was not happy.
No.
But he was asked about that. But I asked him years ago and he was like, I mean, he'd love to, but...
He didn't punch you?
No, he didn't.
No, okay, good. No. Good. No. Good. That's nice. Are either of you excited about And Just Like That?
Yes.
Yes.
I was hoping you were going to bring that up, but I didn't think you would.
Oh, here I am. Go for it.
Yeah. So it's coming December in America. I don't know if that means we're getting it here at the same time. I would like to think so. So it's Sarah Jessica Parker and Cynthia Nixon and Kristen Davis are back. It's the core three. Kim Cattrall is not back. Very exciting. Most of the core cast back. Although, as we address Willie Nelson, Willie Nelson?
Garson.
Yeah. Willie Nelson.
Willie Nelson, the dead country singer. Willie Garson is the dead.
Sorry, Willie. Willie Garson passed away last month, very, very sadly. So I think he did start filming. I don't know what they're going to do with his character Stanford in it. I am very excited, even though the last film was absolutely abominable.
That was hateful.
Absolutely dreadful. And I'm glad they've gone down this route instead of a third film, which at one point genuinely was on the cards. Very exciting. I'm looking forward to it. But yeah, I don't know when we're getting a UK release, which it could mean
it
absolutely anything. Because you know, we've gone over this.
I know, but
HBO, December.
If they don't show it the day after it goes out in America, I will be fucking astonished.
Yeah.
I think they have to. Because so they know the shows that are really, really sought after, they have to show them very quickly.
That's my, because they say, don't they, but... There's that question, you know, after you hear the HBO
you hear the Sopranos
noise.
Theme tune.
Yeah, whose theme song? Mine is Sex in the City.
Oh, mine's 100%. I hear always the Sopranos theme tune.
Oh, I hear Kobe Enthusiasm.
Do you? Yeah. But like, it's funny, when I was watching the trailer for House of the Dragon, as soon as I hear that, I hear the doom, you know, the little Sopranos thing kicks off in my head.
Of course, the exciting thing about the Sex in the City sequel is that Chris Noth.
I was about to say, you've got to remember this. It's Noth.
It's Noth. It's Noth is back as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's, yeah. I think all of them, all of the love interests are back.
Just know Samantha.
It will be fascinating, won't it? Like, when, what it's like.
If she's dead, I'm going to be like, that's...
I don't think she'll be dead.
No.
Having said that, when they're pap shots of them at a funeral scene, I think.
Oh, God, was there?
Well, she had cancer, didn't she? That was the whole thing.
Yeah, it doesn't mean it's her, but if they do kill her off, that's going to feel like a real revenge on her.
It really is.
Savage.
I think they probably will.
Because they're not even I don't think they're even trying to hide the fact that they didn't get on the show at all.
Yeah. She went on, she was on, I hate to say the name, but Piers Morgan's Life Stories, Kim Cattrall, and her description of why she ended up fucking hating them is really, like, it was raw.
Because she talks about it as a campaign of bullying.
And it's rare you get that level of, you know, you get all the rumours, of unrest on set and wars between, particularly between actors, let's face it.
Yeah.
But to have it confirmed by her on the record, on TV, in front of your eyes, was pretty extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, yeah, let's hope they don't go down that route, but I'm so excited. I love it.
Did you ever watch Sex and the City?
I did. I've not seen all of it. I've seen certainly a huge chunk of the final season, including the finale. I watched maybe the first three seasons, but there's definitely a chunk in the middle where I didn't watch it. But I watched quite a bit of it.
Okay.
I remember almost none of it, but I did watch a huge chunk of it. But it was quite, like, certainly for the era, it was quite shocking and bold and progressive.
I loved it. It's incredible.
Yeah.
I was bang on about how shocking I'm trying to avoid the use of the word bold, but you've just said it.
But it is very bold because it was incredibly sex positive before being sex positive was really a thing.
Exactly. Yeah. It was, I remember being in school when it finished, but getting back, having a box set given to me for birthday and getting stuck into it and kind of having those messages go up, especially with Samantha and the idea of being a completely successful, fully formed person with a marvelous career that also really enjoys having promiscuous sex and is safe and happy and fulfilled was pretty fucking groundbreaking. Obviously some of it's aged horribly, but that's true of absolutely everything that was made like 20 plus years ago. So, but yeah, it was such a joy to kind of grow up around that stuff because that was, it did push it out quite a lot. A lot of fluids on that show.
I mean, yeah. Yes, that is actually one of my strongest memories of that show. But that and shoes, they're both.
Oh, yeah.
Fluid and shoes. Yeah. Speaking of fluid and shoes, actually not at all, but you remember the Joseph Gordon-Levitt Apple show, Mr. Yes. Corman? Well, that has been cancelled.
No,
it is no more.
Shock there. I'm
sure Joseph is not thrilled about that, but the rest of us are fine with it.
It was mediocre. Yeah. Wasn't it?
Yeah. I wasn't a fan. Sorry. Do either of you watch Billions?
No.
I watched it for about three seasons, and then but people love it, don't they?
They do. But not so much Damian Lewis because he's left.
Oh.
He's not returning. It has been confirmed that Damian Lewis, obviously the fifth season finale, I think, has aired recently. And Damian Lewis has said he has exited the role as Bobby Axelrod and will not be returning.
Ooh.
So they're going to carry on without him?
Apparently so.
This seems foolish.
Apparently so.
Really? So the whole thing is about Paul Giamatti versus him.
Well, it was when you know we last watched it. I don't know. It might have changed.
I know they got together. Those two are the whole selling point of the show for me. Anyway,
yeah.
So
they are great.
It's a bit like carrying on Sex and the City without
Samantha.
Okay.
All right. Any other thing I saw was that Cruel Intentions is getting a kind of a reboot as a TV series for IMDb TV. IMDb TV, which they are making things, like IMDb TV delivered a big old box to my house yesterday with a blanket in it and a candle.
Same.
Yes.
Yes. And they emailed me saying, did you get our package? And I said, yes, and I haven't done anything.
I said, thank you. Thank you for my blanket and a candle.
Have you not put it on social media? Have you not taken a photo of it?
To be fair, it arrived when I was out and my neighbour picked it up and she dropped it around first thing this morning, and I just quickly, as I was running out the door, it's a blanket and a candle, and then legged it out the door. So, you know, thanks for the blanket and the candle. But yes, IMDb. So no, IMDb TV. We talked about this last week. So this is on Amazon.
It is on for free as part of the Amazon. If you've got Amazon
it is,
Prime,
yeah,
because it's got ads. As you said, it's got kind of minimalish ads.
It's ad supported, and it's mainly films, I think, isn't it? Which is
there's loads of TV. There's some show launching that they
which they sent the screeners for. Yes.
Regina Bellman.
Yes,
which apparently that show's been going for years and I have fucking no idea.
Okay.
You know about that?
Interesting. I didn't know that.
I mean, but that's their big kind of original in quotes launch next Friday. Leverage.
Yes, that's it, which we may or may not review.
Yeah, Leverage colon Redemption, right? So that arrives on
That feels like the sequel to Leverage, like right. Leverage 2, Leverage.
But I didn't even know about Leverage.
Like, do you know about Book
there
2
is a
Ghost.
Show called Leverage. This has been going for years.
And this is Leverage Redemption.
And this is Leverage colon Redemption, which is the kind of new reboot of it.
I've never seen Leverage.
I've never seen Leverage either. But I don't know why it needs redemption. Years.
Yeah.
So there you go.
All right. That's interesting. Anyway, that's on IMDb TV, which you can get on Amazon, and they will send you a blanket and a candle.
Well, they won't send it to everyone.
Fucking candle.
It's guaranteed with every subscriber. Oh, one blanket, one candle.
I would be more excited about Do you know what? I'm not even sure I can talk about it. I was going to say, I'd be more excited about Cruel Intentions, but I've been so badly burned by I Know What You Can Do Last Summer.
Oh, steady.
Just don't name check it. No, just don't
do
name check it.
Do you mean rewatching the film? Is that what you meant?
But just because I got... I just got very excited. You know, it's a film I really love from that era.
But also, Cruel Intentions TV reboot sounds almost exactly the same in my head as to the actual Gossip Girl TV reboot. Which is, you know...
It's pretty good.
In my head, it's pretty good.
I thought Cruel Intentions had already been a TV show spin-off. Like, I could swear. But maybe it's just because they all seem the same.
Sarah Michelle Gellar was in it.
Was she?
Yeah, I think you're right.
Someone, if only there was some kind of website where we could look this stuff up.
Yeah.
I know the sequels were dreadful. There's one of the sequels had Amy Adams in, I think.
Oh, yeah, the sequels were like almost pretty much straight to video, weren't they?
Yeah. She's doing some sort of... dodgy stuff on a horse.
Yeah.
I've got Sarah Michelle Gellar here in Cruel Intentions in 2016.
Yes.
Oh, so she did a TV movie.
Right.
It's a TV movie. It's not a series, it's a TV movie. Okay. Never seen that. Never will.
A couple of other things that I may or may not be parachuting in as I edit this because we missed it when we recorded it. But Foundation, glorious Foundation, has been renewed for season 2 ahead of finishing season 1. That is extremely good news. Whether David S. Goyer will get 80 episodes as he wants, which remains to be seen, but we're one step closer. And also, perhaps even more excitingly, Catherine Hahn is getting her own WandaVision spin-off series focusing on Agatha. Which are pretty cool. Jack Schaefer's going to be along for the ride for that as well. It was indeed Agatha all along.
Any other news before we move on?
No, surely that's
no. I think we're done, aren't we? Let's move on to the reviews. And first up, we have the belated return of You. Not literally You, but You, the Netflix series. Never gets old. This is, of course, the Stalker series on Netflix, which not really a laughing matter subject-wise, somehow still managed to emerge as a kind of surprisingly entertaining guilty pleasure when it emerged in 2018. So this is based on the book by Caroline Kepnes, and it stars Penn Badgley as Joe, an extremely creepy bookstore clerk with an odd notion of romance, shall we say. euphemism of the year. So now, as we enter series 3, Joe is actually married to Victoria Pedretti's love. They've got a newborn baby and a house in the suburbs, but is family life all it's cracked up to be for your common or garden sociopath? And I think the person who should review this is you.
He's pointing at Beth.
I'm pointing at you. You can review it, and then me and Boyd will obviously instantly forget about it, and then Boyd will review it afterwards.
Say exactly the same thing. So I watched the first two seasons of this. I think that introducing Victoria Pedretti was genius. That was straight off the back of Blythe Manor, wasn't it?
It would have been pre-Blythe Manor, wouldn't it? It would have been straight off the back of Hill House,
yes. So kind of brought her in off the back of that fanfare, which was great. And the fact that she, I guess we can say spoiler-wise, that she turns out to be not 100% an angel.
Well, it's been a couple of years. I think we can safely say that. Okay. They're well matched.
They're well matched. Yes. They're well matched.
Fair warning to people. Yeah, if you haven't finished
season two, if you've not watched any,
it's hard to review season 3 without referring to what did happen.
100%. Yeah.
So I think that was great to bring her in. And now we find Joe, as you say, in the suburbs. He's got two, you know, he was able to kind of move around to his own pace right up until he meets love. You know, he kind of goes wrong and does all sorts of terrible things. And yeah, it got some pretty shady responses from young women off the back of this. I remember there was a series of women would just tweet Penn Badgley and be like, kidnap me.
That's, and he was like, not funny.
And he'd like quote tweet them and say, "No, this is not okay, guy. Yeah. Like this is not what we wanted for this." But yeah, so he was kind of moving at his own pace, just going around, wink, wink, kill, kill, and then he finds love, literally. Yeah. And yeah, by the end of it, she's pregnant, and now he has these two permanent fixtures in his life. He has love, and he has Henry the baby.
Mm. You know what they say, Beth? Couples that slay together stay together.
That's very cute. Oh, that's horrifying. Yeah, so they're living together in the suburbs, still find a way to kind of resort back to old tendencies, shall we say. But what's different this time, and I don't think this necessarily works for me, is that they're really pushing for the empathy card for Joe. So whereas they were very, very vocal about the fact that we should not be on the side of Joe, want Joe to kidnap us in any way, go on any dates with Joe, you know, just be in sort of 100 feet of Joe in the first two seasons, we're now sort of being set up to feel sorry for Joe. So we're seeing these flashbacks of his childhood where he's being bullied by a big group of, it could be Nate, let's be honest, it could be Nate from Ted Lasso.
His hair gets grayer as the episode goes on.
So we're sort of dealing with that. He's now as well playing off the back of somebody who also has murderous tendencies and a taste for violence. And then as well, they're playing off against these very villainous people in the suburbs. It becomes increasingly political. We've got kind of comments on anti-vaxxers. We've got this awful kind of influencer woman running amok on the suburbs called Kiki, who through voiceover, Joe is sort of explaining that she does all these kind of staged protests and woke culture, cancel culture, and all of these things, all these topical political things that are put up. And I feel like increasingly, I've not finished it, I've watched about four episodes, I feel like we're just being pushed closer and closer towards them and empathizing with these two people, whereas before what I enjoyed about it was entertaining to just see them be ghastly and violent, and it was a little bit trashy, whereas this, I feel like it's trying to be a little bit more politically involved, a bit more ingrained in the cultural fabric. And yeah, they're really pushing this empathy card. Maybe I'm just too sympathetic, but I just feel like they're really pushing for us to kind of be on the side of these people. Whereas what I liked about it before is we could kind of be on the outside looking in and just watch all this, like, you know, it's like Squid Game kind of thing, this kind of distanced clinical violence. God, maybe I'm a psychopath. Maybe this is
it's what's possible.
Coming out.
It's possible.
Yeah, maybe. I think if you are, we all are. It is trashy. That's what I love about it.
Yeah,
I think
it's unashamedly so.
It's still trashy because of course it's narrated by him. Isn't it? You know, by Penn Badgett. So you're having a show about a psychopath who kidnaps people and kills them all. Sometimes lets it go various ways. No, he does the narration. You are taken into his mind in that way, and he is trying to make you feel sympathy for him. I mean, half the time, or at least to some extent, I think. But that's what makes it's one of the least annoying voiceover based shows I can think of. I find too much voiceover really irritating.
Yeah,
generally.
But he's funny.
But he's
really, really funny.
Yeah. And the scripts are really sharp and clever. And Victoria Petracci, as you say, is the masterstroke, because bringing her in, we just happen to have, you know, wouldn't you know it, we've got two fucking psychopaths in a relationship with a baby. Yeah. Is a great setup for this series, this new season, I think. And they don't waste it. Like, I think, and I also like, apparently, I was reading up on it, Caroline Kemner, who wrote the book, the first book, she has written three books about this, these characters now. And this is kind of loosely based on the third book, and season two is loosely based on the second book, so they're pretty lucky that they've got her beavering away, keeping these things going. But
George R. Martin could probably take a few.
Yeah, right, indeed. Exactly. but it's one of those shows where if you step back from it for more than like a minute and think about it, it's absolutely preposterous bullshit from start to finish.
Yeah,
it is insanely ludicrous, but I love that about it, that it just doesn't give a shit and these things happen in it. Like at the end of episode one of season three, you're like, okay, that's where we are. It poodles along, doesn't it, kind of for a bit, being a bit weird and introducing these characters, and you're like, oh, and being quite kind of, you know, satirical about YouTubers and influencers and mum, there's a mum, woman in that who you talked about, who's really irritating, and their mates, and they go to cafes and they talk about
keto diets and whatnot.
All that bullshit. But, and yet, you know, amazingly mad things happen in it that keep you absolutely glued to it. I love it. I think it's so entertaining. And I think Penn Badgley and Pedretti are brilliant together. And
they
really,
are wonderful.
Really funny and entertaining.
Yeah.
So
this
yeah.
was the Christmas watch in 2018 yeah. and 2019. And I binged these, and he's just delightful. And I think they've done a really smart turn here because he is objectively on paper like a horrifying character.
Yeah.
He fixates on women, stalks them, and in some cases murders them all in the name of his twisted idea of what love is. Like he keeps like in this one, like there's a box where he's got like his stolen underwear and like a used tampon, and it's just like, oh God. I mean, it's just vile.
Yes.
And yet he finds a way to make that character partially sympathetic, but if not likable. He's likable regardless. And I do think that the genius stroke for this is, again, they make a point to think, right, he's a terrible character, so we'll surround him by people who are bigger bellends than him.
Yeah.
That's the masterstroke. Yeah, and I think the transition from scary stalker guy in season one, and again, surrounded by bellends, which is why you find him more sympathetic. It's like the Roy family or the other people in the show. And but season two of this, it stopped being what it began and became like full Dexter. It went full Dexter. Yeah. And I like that this is like an evolution of that. Now it's Mr. and Mrs. Dexter in series three. Yeah. And it's just a guilty pleasure. And it's, but it's interesting because it's an evolution of that formula. Like Dexter worked because the whole idea was Dexter. Yes, he's a serial killer, but he only kills bad people. And then this is like, yes, he's a stalker, but he only kills bellends. So it's okay. They're not evil, but they're bellends. So it's fine. But yeah, it's trash and it's incredibly watchable. And I love it. And I've been mainlining this for, well, a number of days this week. And it's great.
Yeah, it's huge fun.
We've had to wait a couple of years, but it's well worth the wait. You, of course, now back on Netflix and begins on Netflix on Friday the 15th. Next up, we have Cobra Cyber War, in which Robert Carlyle's Prime Minister has to deal with yet another hugely overblown catastrophe as a ship blows up and Russians attack. And needless to say, it doesn't go well. So insert your own dysfunctional British government joke here. Boydie,
yes.
What did you think of Cobra Cyber War?
Did we review season one?
We did.
I had pretty much the same sentiment, which was that I think you and Terry thought it was pretty bad.
Yes.
Okay, and I quite enjoyed it despite myself. the thing I should say, I love this kind of stuff. So I'm a big fan of 80s kind of disaster movies meets politics.
Yeah.
And so I love disaster movies, absolutely love them. From, you know, Towering Inferno is one of my favourite films, Poseidon Adventure, Bring Them On, absolutely fantastic. And right all the way through to 2012 and all those ones. And I also love political dramas, you know, so, you know, from West Wing to all the others there are. So it has to be pretty damn shit for me not to quite enjoy the basic idea of it, which is to mush those things together so that, you know, in the first series, it was like this big electrical...
It was like a solar storm, wasn't it? And it caused blackouts.
Yeah, blackouts and aeroplanes to crash from the sky, which was like in the very first episode. And they convene Cobra, Cobra's now mainly famous for things that the Prime Minister doesn't go to.
Robert Carlyle, however, does.
Yeah, he's busy having holidays and stuff. But Robert Carlyle being a good version, he's a Tory, but he's kind of like a Dave Cameron style Tory. So he's kind of like that. Victoria Hamilton plays his number two, and she's always brilliant in everything. Yeah. I love Victoria Hamilton. Yeah. So this does have the benefit. Richard Dormer is like the kind of whiz kid of solving huge, big global problems. That's his job. And David Haig, who is brilliant in everything, and I love, who is one of the most camp, over-the-top actors, just generally.
Yeah. He's amazing.
He is amazing in it. He was like the Home Secretary, series one, and he's back in series two somehow. And as soon as he arrives on screen, like wanting to get back into the cabinet, I was like, oh, yes, he's back. David Haig's back, and it's really funny and over-the-top.
Scheming in a gentleman's club.
Yeah, scheming in a ludicrously, to cut to the chase, he says. Like, no, did you want to say that?
That was good.
In real life, thanks. I fucking love him. So it's got all these elements that I really like. So I'm very much predisposed to enjoying it. And I did enjoy it. The thing that people said about it, and I think I'm pretty sure that you and Terry said about it at the time, is that it feels a bit cheap, and it's, you know, because it is trying to do these huge big things.
Yeah.
There's a big helicopter exploding, flying into a school set piece in episode
one. Pretty sure it was done with matchbox models, but
right. Yeah. You're going to say that. So I remember there was one review for series one that was like, this is pitiful, like cheap. Yeah. But it's not, I don't think it is that bad technically. I think it's fine. Like,
We're just used to it.
I think it's not. Yeah, and Vigil's a good example. Yeah, we're spoiled. So everything is like technically and, you know, beautifully made. And I think this is pretty well made. It's just, it's clearly not like as massive a budget as certain shows. Like probably if it was on Netflix, it would probably look, you know, it might be even more ambitious and better. Mm. But considering what it's covering, huge, big global events and disasters and the implications of them politically, I think it's great fun. I think the main weakness of it is that Robert Carlyle's character isn't very interesting. So he's the prime minister. That's the most interesting thing about him. I think if he was more of a Boris Johnson figure as opposed to Dave Cameron figure, it would be better.
He's a bit bland.
And I know why they're doing that, because again, it can surround him a bit U-style with Bellens, who have more personality, played by David Haig. But I just feel like if he was more objectionable and, you know, just more of a, as I say, a classic objectional twat of a Tory, I think it would be more entertaining than it is. I think it, to use that very trend, leans into being fair, you know. So he's a Tory, but we're not going to hate him.
Yeah.
But actually, you want a hate figure, don't you, really?
Yeah, I think, well, you just need a personality, don't you? And I think, in a way, that's where the casting lets us down, because with Robert Carlyle, I'm sorry, even after all these years, you want Begbie.
Yeah.
Like, that's what you're expecting. We're getting a Begbie show, for goodness
sake. I was about to say, we didn't mention that in news. There's going to be a Begbie spin-off show.
Yeah. This is it. And I think in that casting, you were expecting character, you were expecting aggression, you are expecting anything other than this extreme. And I mean, he is a Tory, but a very conservative, very measured leader. Mm. Who's just, I wrote in my notes, he looks like everybody's dad did in like the later lockdown, like distressed and gone and pissed off, not quite sure really what's going to happen next, not quite sure what's going on, don't really know what to do, but, you know, just grimly kind of bunkering down and getting through the next thing. And I think, that I would have liked to have seen a bit more like showmanship from my fictional prime minister, really. So that's sort of where it let it down for me a little bit. I mean, it was fine. I watched one episode in the end and it was absolutely fine. I just think other shows are doing better in terms of budget and storytelling. And I do like that it does riff off two actual political parties and draws that into the story. Aside from things like West Wing or like The Thick of It, that doesn't really happen very often. Yeah, so that was quite cool to see.
And there's a good podcaster character I quite like here, who was played by the guy from I May Destroy You. Remember?
I May Destroy You, which got name checked in the Ted Lasso finale. I really liked him in I May Destroy You.
That was amazing.
Was it in the finale? Anyway, but it was in one of them.
Yeah, there's an author character who she gets involved with in I May Destroy You. He's a really interesting character, actually. And he plays the podcast. I thought it was quite funny that they have a podcast right at the centre of events. It's sort of quite interesting at all. But
I think Beth absolutely nailed it there. I was listening, and
just so you can say that,
100%. I was absolutely listening to everything Beth was just saying, and it was great. No, but you're right. It's like, it's not that this is bad. It's just the shows are doing it a lot better, and it's that classic thing. Like, remember when we watched The Widow, and we're like, if this had come out in 2000, I would be watching this religiously. Mm. But it isn't 2000, and the same with this. Like, you know, 20 years ago, this would be absolute appointment viewing, and now it's just lost in the noise, and it's not bad. And you're right, there's high stakes, there's drama, there's disaster, you know, there's political intrigue, there's amazing characters, all of which are David Haig. but you know, it's just, it's not done well enough to make me think I'm going to block aside time to watch every episode of this. Like, watch the first one, I'm probably going to do what I did with season one. Watch the first one, like, yeah, okay, fine. Next, you know, and I think that's where I fall with this. So I don't think it's bad at all. I just think it's vying for our most precious resource, which is our time. And, you know, not being funny, but there's a lot of stuff out there. So sorry, Cobra.
Yeah.
But anyway, Cobra does arrive on Sky, or begins, I should say, on Sky Max on Friday, October the 15th at 9 p.m. And finally, this week, we are getting our Ingmar Bergman on in HBO's Scenes from a Marriage, which is a modern remake of Bergman's 70s miniseries of the same name. And this takes a look at contemporary coupling, focusing principally on Oscar Isaac's Jonathan and Jessica Chastain's Mira. Beth, were there incredible scenes from a marriage?
Yeah. Oh my God. Wow. I mean, this to a degree is fail-proof. I think you've got Bergman's source material, you've got Jessica Chastain and Oscar Isaac, and the groundwork for this has been so beautifully laid with that now very viral video that exists from Venice Film Festival, which, if you have not seen
I haven't seen it. What is it?
Are you being serious?
I'm 100% serious.
I implore you to go and find this.
Classic textbook James.
What's their dragons in it? If not, I haven't seen it.
No.
So Empire writer Christina Newland actually tweeted this. It's this incredible video of Oscar Isaac Jessica Chastain on the red carpet at Venice.
Oh, the slow motion thing. Yes. I have seen that. Yeah, so it is like the sexiest thing that's ever been on the internet.
Good. Like I'm blushing as I'm talking about it.
Yeah.
But it's this real glacial, like, sweep, and it has been slowed down. This, although it does feel like this is what they would just do in real life anyway, but it's this very glacial sweep of Jessica Chastain's back from Oscar Isaac, and just a shared look, and Oscar Isaac playing every single one of us for every sexual urge that we have.
Yeah.
So yeah, the groundwork with this has been like beautifully laid in terms of like the pair's chemistry and their compatibility. And so with that in mind, given that it is at the core about their very tumultuous marriage, like, it's all there. It's there, ready to eat with a spoon. And then it is just a very meaty, very dialogue-heavy, dramatic miniseries, which is everything that should work about this show. It works wonderfully. It is just, that is what it is. So I think the way I've written about it in my notes is it's like a prestige version of the breakup episode of Friends, where the rest of the friends are locked brilliant. In the bedroom and Ross and Rachel are spending the whole episode talking about what works in the relationship, what doesn't work in the relationship, and what's going to happen next with the relationship. This is what happens over this entire series, only if Ross was like, you know, a good person and Rachel was like a woman in tech. Like, that's what we're dealing with here. It's just a couple very much getting into the depths of their marriage and the depths of their personalities and how their past traumas and relationships are feeding into this marriage. That is it. That's what you're getting. So with that in mind, it's just very, it's how I felt about The Morning Show a little bit as well, where I had to watch it a lot in quick succession. It is very intense, very dialogue driven. There's a lot of feelings, and not just like the perma feels, as Sophie says, and I will mention this in every single episode because it's such
yes,
a good
you
phrase. You know, it's not just this sort of, oh, it's like, oh, like you really get dragged into like the trenches with them as they're like battling it out, trying to, you know, get to the fundamentals. And Oscar Isaac's character, he was an Orthodox Jew, and he's abandoned his religion. So that's coming from it. Jessica Chastain's character is the product of a string of abusive relationships. And the way that they meet each other is interesting. You hear about it all through a therapy session. It begins in therapy. Like, that's what we're dealing with. It's like feelings from the off, just people chatting out their feelings. So it is exquisitely performed, wonderfully written. It's all of those things that make it incredibly prestige. It's just incredibly intense with not a lot of respite, really. Yeah. And I think, again, and this is the product of how we watch shows for this podcast, it has meant having to watch episodes very intensely in very quick succession, which is going to probably, you know, sway a little bit how I feel about this. But yeah, it's foolproof, but just a fucking lot.
I thought it was an unbearable bore.
yes,
go
boys.
On, boy. Come drag on. It. Drag it.
Get out the popcorn.
I'm sorry. And I, you know, I the thing about the Venice Film Festival arm touching video, to which you quite rightly refer, is I'd rather watch that for 5 minutes than this, because there's more chemistry there between them than there is in the show. I think they're so boring, both of them. And I think it's mainly the fault of the script.
Mm.
Like, they are not interesting characters. The only interesting thing about them is that they are having this breakup, or they're having those their relationship issues.
Mm.
And that's not enough. Like, you know, because there have been loads of, like, Marriage Story was a film massively inspired by scenes from a marriage,
yeah.
Right? The film with, you know, I forget
Adam
everyone's
Driver,
names. Thank you, Adam Driver.
Scarlett Hansen.
Thank you, Scarlett Hansen. And that was brilliant. I loved that film. But they were, right from the off, powerful, sharp, funny characters who were like having slanging matches that were compelling and entertaining.
Mm.
These two are kind of banal and bland, and I don't think the dialogue isn't particularly like dialogue needs to be more heightened. If I'm going to watch 5 fucking hours of basically 2 people interrupted every now and then by another couple maybe or whatever,
yeah.
But essentially 2 people tearing strips off each other, I need it to be funny and witty and sharp. It's just I just found it incredibly boring and repetitive. And I think they're kind of weirdly miscast. Like, I just don't think they're interesting. Like, imagine it. Right, seriously, Penn Badgley and, you know, Victoria Petracci. I'd rather see them in this show than these two. So that, even they are the most prestigious actors. And they're, you know, and they've played Husband and Wife before in Most Violent Year, that film.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I don't think they have, I didn't believe it at all. I thought it was very, the main problem is the script, though. It's by the Israeli guy who did In Treatment, who wrote it. And I just think it's just not, I just don't think the dialogue's interesting enough. You know, it really, and you know, I can think of loads of films and TV shows that are basically about a relationship and forensically, and Master of None, Series 3, I don't know if you watch that, which is about two women in this kind of situation. Mm. That's better, you know, really, really entertaining, funny. You know, there are just loads of examples. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? You know, like this is like the anti, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? It's like a terrifying, Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor tearing chunks of each other, and it is amazing. And this is like two people like, you know,
who is okay
whining.
With Virginia Woolf.
You know, right. It's like they're just fucking whining at each other for 5 hours. I found it borderline unbearable. I'm serious.
Wow.
And I really was excited about it because I love...
You're among the stars, isn't it?
I was really excited by the prospect of it. But you know, I think Liv Ullmann, you know, was in Scenes from a Marriage, and I just think she's... I think Ingmar Bergman knew what he was doing more than Haggai Levy, to name him, the writer-director of this. I was absolutely gutted by how boring it was. I could not believe how boring it was. Sorry.
I love it when you throw a curveball. It always entertains me. I have to say, I was shocked by how much I loved this.
Oh my God.
Like
what is happening?
I was a little bit like I have not got the fucking patience to watch this shit. And I put it on and I was doing sort of like, as I have a tendency to do sometimes when I've got it, I play it picture in picture on my iPad while I'm writing the script for Pilot, because I always do these things last minute. And I kept stopping writing and I couldn't write. And I found it absolutely sort of hypnotically magnetic. I couldn't tear my eyes off it. And I know what you mean, because it is not, like, not a lot happens and it's not overdone. They're not screaming at each other. It's not fights. It's affection, but with layered microaggressions in there. It's very subtle. Like, on the face of it, they have a decent relationship, externally speaking. They think they have a good relationship, but you see the cracks early on. And I just thought, just to your point, Boyd, I thought the chemistry with them was like nothing I'd ever seen.
Oh my God.
Like, genuinely, I was just like, I believe this so wholeheartedly that they have this layer of sort of palpable affection and love, but it's been tempered over time and the novelty's gone and it's worn a little bit, as all long-term relationships are, let's not forget. Like, it happens to everyone, you know, that bit where you take each other for granted and there are little things about your partner which irritate you, which once you didn't mind, now you want to smother them in their sleep, you know. But and I loved it, and like the conversation between them and just the nuanced performances, just like, in terms of acting masterclasses, I was like, these two are fucking incredible. Just the way
Penn Badgley.
The expressions on their faces when they are sitting on that couch talking to that kind of PhD researcher. And just the little, and just Chastain in particular, I have to say, I was just like, I am in awe of her. And when they have that sort of that dinner party with Corey Stoll and his partner come down there, and they have this like really awkward conversation about gossip, which I thought was interesting in the way it was performed, but also it was a big discussion about you know polyamorous relationships and the pitfalls of them, and how, as I think is not uncommon, where they work for one partner a lot more than they work for the other partner.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really interesting conversation they had, layered with the awkwardness of having essentially a domestic in front of your friends, which is super awkward. And then the kiss moment, which comes soon afterwards, which you're like, whoa!
Just relentless.
And the awkwardness after that is played to perfection as well. To me, this was... It worked on two levels. From a pure acting point of view, I was like, this is people at the top of their game. And also, I just thought, you know, the script isn't showy, but I thought what it did was, and I think the performances, like, the script alone doesn't do this. I think it's a combination of these incredible performances. They're what I thought was incredible chemistry. And I thought the screenplay brought out from those performances was a I'm not going to use the word verisimilitude, even though Terry isn't here to take the piss out of me, but there's an organic legitimacy, a truthfulness to it. There was something about this that just felt very real to me. It was so believable.
Yeah.
And that alone made it so compelling to me. And while Among the Stars last week literally had me wanting to sort of bludgeon myself to death with a space shuttle model, like, this I could have watched all day. I did. I loved it to be
bits.
Oh my goodness.
And not just to troll you, boy. This is not just an incredibly elaborate trolling.
We haven't even talked about the real the other incredible thing about it that irritated me so much is the pretentious gimmick they have of opening each episode with the actors getting ready for their role.
Okay, that threw me. I mean, what is this? Hell.
But for me, that was such a misjudgment, because it's basically the creator's way of saying, look, this show is so amazing, it's so real, it's so believable, and we've done such a brilliant job that even if we introduce them as actors getting ready for the role, you're still going to believe that everything. And I'm like, no, you're just being an utter massive pretentious
because also
twat.
I didn't know what the show was when that happened. I was like, so what, is she an actor? Like, what's happening?
No, she's but also watching a poor assistant having to get rid of her gum for her.
Crucially, like, that looked to me, it didn't look like, oh, that's Jessica Chastain getting ready for the scene. I felt like an incredibly artificial and fake look at, you know, and I was like,
it was really
I mean, that
weird.
Was super pretentious, incredibly ill-advised. That needs to go and die and kill it with fire.
Well, that's the first thing that happened. So that got me, that riled me
I'm
up.
I'm with you on that. That's terrible.
I wish I'd watched you watching that.
Yeah, that was hateful. That was hateful. Yeah. Other than that,
well, I mean, I can't separate it from that fucking ridiculous device.
That's so funny. I'd forgotten about that.
Oh, I've enjoyed this. It's good. I like when we disagree on these things. But that is Scenes from a Marriage, and it comes to, it's a four-parter, I want to say.
Five, I think.
Five-parter.
Yeah.
And this starts on Sky Atlantic on Monday, October the 11th at 9 p.m. What else is out this week, buddy?
Well, there is the second series. Well, I know what we did last summer, which we weren't allowed to review.
Yes, it's embargoed. One of us may have watched that.
Two of us may have watched that.
I have many things to say.
Can possibly comment. But it is I think it's a 10-part
TV. I thought you were going to say it's a 10-star show.
I have no idea how many stars it will be. But it does arrive on Amazon Prime on Friday. And it is a TV series it was a novel, basically. So apart from being a classic 90s kind of stalking / horror film, I know it does summer. It started out as a novel.
Oh.
And yeah. And this is, as they say, you know, a close 1973 novel. But we have watched it. I was about to start reviewing it, but so we can't say.
Here we go,
it's very self-consciously modern, isn't it, Beth? Like, there's lots of mobile phones and stuff.
It's the wifeification, is what it is.
Right. It's the wifeification. Right. But no, we can't judge it. We can't review it because it's embargoed.
I know what you did in the early 90s, and it was watch this film, and now we made a TV show.
Yes. Exactly. There's Guilt, which I think for the second series running, I apologize for us not reviewing it. Really should have, because it's really, really good. It's Mark Bonner, it's basically like the first series with these brothers got involved in a hit and run. It was all about the cover up, the unwise, you know, what happens if you unwisely try and cover something up. And then this is the new series of that with the same characters, Mark Bonner back. Mark Bonner is brilliant in everything. It's really good. That's on BBC Two on Thursday.
Another Life is back for season two on Netflix. That's the one with Katie Sackhoff. If you remember, I took objection to the unrealistic threesome in that. And that's what made me, I was watching it. I was here for it. They had an unrealistic threesome. And I stopped watching it. But that is a science fiction show on Netflix, and that starts on the 14th.
Dave, your favourite.
Oh, Little Dicky.
Yeah, Little Dicky. That will have started yesterday, Sunday, series two, and it's all on iPlayer. And again, that's another show that I really should have insisted we review, because I think it's fucking amazing. Have you ever seen it, Beth?
No.
Okay. But it is absolutely, it really addresses, like, full on. Ideas like in the new series, kind of white privilege and mental illness and having a small penis, having a deformed penis. incredible stuff it addresses, but in a brilliantly funny way. I think it's amazing. But you hated it, didn't you? Didn't you?
Me and Terry, in fact, all three of us didn't like it much, but then you revisited it and you did a reverse ferret.
I did a massive reverse ferret, That's back. That's all on iPlayer. The whole thing is on iPlayer now.
The 100's final season, so The 100, which is a YA show, which is actually halfway decent. I watched, I think, the first three seasons of this before, you know, stopping. But season seven comes to Four Music, which sounds to me like a radio channel, but apparently that's an actual TV channel.
Four Music, I believe it might even be co-owned by our parent company, Bell.
Oh, is it?
I think so. Oh, yeah, it certainly was at one point.
Why The 100 is on Four Music, I don't know.
They do show some quite good TV. Like, okay. Good TV on Four Music.
That comes at 9 p.m. on the 15th.
There's two Disney Plus things, Just Beyond, which is an 8-part comedy anthology from R.L. Stine, Source Material.
Yes, Goosebumps, man.
Yeah, Goosebumps and Fear Street fame. That starts on Wednesday on Disney Plus. And Reservation Dogs also premieres, which is the Native American teenage show co-created by Taika Waititi.
There's a lot of good stuff this week. Also, Hightown is back for a second season. I think we quite enjoyed that. That's on Starz Play on the 17th.
Yeah, and there's loads of stuff that if I mention will annoy you, but like Portrait Artist of the Year, amazing show. That's back on Sky.
Stop it. Just stop
on
it.
Wednesday. And there's a brilliant Paul Merson documentary tonight on BBC One, everyone, Arsenal player, about his addictions. It's
anything else, Boyd? What's happening in Brookside?
See, that's what I've talked with. Yeah. No, that's enough.
What's our pick of the week? Boyd's is obviously Scenes from a Marriage.
Yeah. No, it's you, which is better at in long-term relationship analysis than Scenes from a Marriage.
More believable. Yeah. Believable's the big word. I'm going to go Scenes from a Marriage.
I love Scenes from a Marriage, but for me, you is just, it's so trashily joyous. I love it. So that is probably it for me. Well, that is it, I guess, for this week's show. It is not as long as the week before last. So please use this time we're giving back to you to head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star rating. Unless, like Beth, you've already written one and Boyd and I have simply forgotten. Follow us on social media at James C. Dyer, at Boyd Hilton, at Beth K. Webb, and make sure to tune in next week when we'll be talking about Apple's invasion, or rather, we would if the rather harsh embargo permitted us to do so, but it doesn't.
Succession.
Yes. You have to wait for the week after for invasion, but it's all okay because we will be able to talk about the original Bel End Fest, Succession, as Boyd says, which will be returning for its third season. Which, interestingly enough, and not to spoil anything, but Alan Sepinwall, famous Rolling Stone TV critic, who has never been a fan of Succession, has done a reverse ferret on Succession with season 3. So maybe this is my moment, Boyd, to revise my position.
That's exciting because I love Alan Sepinwall and he's got brilliant taste.
Yes,
he wrote the Sopranos book, didn't he?
Yes, he did indeed. Yeah, he's great. But he's done a reverse ferret on Succession, so maybe I will too. Who knows? And we might also have a look at Netflix's sort of door-obsessed YA show Lock and Key as well. We'll see what happens. Until then,
love it.
Pilot out.